So just to introduce myself, Steve Pritchard, a guy who lives in the UK, not too far from Champagne. So it's just about doable with the Channel Tunnel in about 5.5 hours. And I sort of fell into Champagne about 25 years ago, just before the millennium. It was an area that I found extremely challenging. No disrespect to Jasper, but the still ones for me are probably more about sight and more about the growers themselves, whereas Champagne was this whole technical process, this front-to-end process involving vineyards, people, vinification, and with so many dynamics and complexities. And, you know, coming from an IT originally, I was a games programmer back in the day for Nintendo and Sega, and then through the years, you know, business software and project management for IT. It really, really sort of ticked my buttons in terms of problem solving and you know, analysis. As Michael mentioned, you know, I've spent the last sort of few years writing various articles for Tom Canavan's Wine Pages, so for both Grand Marks and growers as well. My approach, as I mentioned, to Champagne is a technical one. I enjoy Champagne for Champagne's sake, but what I also like to know is, why does this Champagne taste this way? What is it about this that I like? What did the grower do, or what happened in that vintage or in that vineyard? To encourage me, you know, encourage me to sort of think about it and understand, you know, the aromas and the structure and the things that you get the other side, you know, why are they there? So to cut a long story short, so Jasper and I sort of talked about a 2008 horizontal, something he wanted to do, you know, move into Pinot Noir and Chardonnay outside of the Burgundy region. And so that segued nicely into a more longer term relationship. So I'm in a good part in terms of my life, in terms of having some space and time to dedicate more time to this sort of endeavor. So here I am. So hopefully over the next sort of few years, there'll be more articles coming, maybe one every 6 weeks or 2 months. Hopefully we'll get a chance to catch up a lot more in the future and discuss all things Champagne. So I think without further ado, shall we just go right into our sort of first flight? Excuse me. So we're on a bit of a grand magical mystery tour of the appellations of Champagne. So we're starting off in the Montagne de Reims, and then we're going to head right south to the via the Côte de Blanc and Avize, and head down to the Aube, and then we're coming back more towards the north for our final flight, which is Ulithe-Colline, which is based in the Côte de Cézanne, which is just south of the Côte de Blanc. A nice sort of variation of styles here. I'm going to go very quickly in terms of, you know, these are definitely in a grower style, in a more modern grower style. So emphasis on sight, emphasis on oak. I would say more sympathetic vinification. You know, if we look at the Grand Marks, they tend to sort of almost science to death the production of their wines, whereas the growers like to sort of be more sympathetic and more considerate to their sights. So in the first flight, did you say you poured six wines there, Michael? Is that correct? The first six of our list?
Yeah, so we have five at the moment.
Five, okay. Brèche. So we have three Brèche and two Aigle, yeah?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay, so let's just talk about the Brèche in general. So a historic grower producer, it started back in 1847, and a label that I tried on and off over the years, they sort of came onto the radar. You know, they have quite a large number of holdings now. I mean, when they started off back in the day, I think they had just a couple of hectares, and now they have 9.5 hectares all over the Montagne de Reims. You know, Jean-Pierre and Catherine, they've handed over to Raphael and Vincent, you know, and you can see since those guys took over in the early 2000s, there's been a real definite change in philosophy, you know, embracing more oak, individualizing sites in the Champagnes, lowering the dosage, which seemed to be, you know, a bit more of a bit more of a thing now in growers Champagne. If we start with the first wine, which is Le Crin, which I think is the wine that made them famous. So the Crin on the Lude Terroir, which is the northern Montagne de Reims, it is a fine point at the top of the hill, and it's very, very easy to see. And this comes from two vineyards. So we have the Haute Plante, which is on the west facing portion, and then the Van Saint-Jean. I have to look that one up because it's a new one for me. These are a half-hectare parcel, in total 45-year vines, and mainly planted to chalk. So if you look at these, they're quite sloped, and you know, a lot of topsoil erosion, so you get a lot of mineral intensity of the wine. So do we want to start with the maybe the two 2014s together? So let's quickly jump to I. a double plot, Brise Pot and Froidteur. The first one is a 50% Pinot Noir, 50% Chardonnay. This one is 80% Pinot Noir and 20% Chardonnay. And again, west facing and a really steep 45% gradient for the eye plot. So do we just want to have a little taste of those before we talk about 2014? Do we have some initial feedbacks from the first wines?
I find the first one, it's a bit rounder,
yeah,
but as intense or as long as the second one. And then I've already kind of skipped on to the third one. I really like the third one, but maybe I'll pause there. I don't know if anyone else can add.
Yeah, so that's unusual because, I mean, Lude on the Northern Montagne Durance, you would tend to find more chiseled and warmer wines, yet I think what we can probably say in 2014, it was an unusual vintage. So there was a lot of botrytis in the Pinot Noir. So it's more of a Chardonnay vintage, really, in terms of the Côte de Blanc was very, very successful. I think also as well, if you look at the Grand Valley de la Marne, which is where I is on the near the river, that suffered quite a lot. So the Montagne Durance tends to be the better Pinot Noir terroir of that vintage. So the fact that it's a little more rounder is not necessarily because it has less structure or extract. It may be because it's just a warmer vintage for them. And they had less Drosophila, fruit fly infection, which they had quite a lot of that in eye. So you tend to get a lot more bitterness in the wines and botrytis bitterness as well, that apricot sort of aroma in the eye portion. Is there any other feedback on those wines? What do you think of the my personal favorite, actually? I mean, I just love Le Crin. Vintage in, vintage out. It's always a wine that, to me, sort of really emphasizes the Beresh style. That is, we have that citrus sort of laced sort of complexity, you know, that thrust of Chardonnay, but it always has that savoriness of the oak based Pinot Noir. What about for you guys?
First one is quite acidic.
Yeah,
the acidity seems to be very strong. Yes. So step number three, I think number three is a little more rounded, a little more ready. And so the question is that how long can you hold on? Because to me, the acidity, I mean, you can go for another easily 5 years.
So, let's talk about acidity and aging of champagne. So acidity is an indicator, but not necessarily the most important one of ageworthiness. So when we look at when winemakers look to see how their wines will age, they look at pH. Which is, you know, not necessarily the same as acidity. It's related to it, of course. But I think balance and dry extract and neutrality as well in terms of neutral base ones are also good indicators. So I think it's interesting that 2014 for Pinot Noir is probably one I would not age for the long term. I would age in the medium term. There's probably a little too much oxidative tendency because of the fruit fly infections, because of the botrytis of the year. That means that I would probably consider those wines a medium-term bet. But knowing Beresh, you know, they don't have the issues of some growers. So they are excellent wines in their own right, but they are wines to be enjoyed, you know, with that real 3 to 5 year post-disgorgement uplift that you tend to get in champagne, that real sort of pickup in aroma. I think Ambonnay in 2016. So 2016 is a little bit more of a riper year in terms of the fruit, although you do have that sort of nice acidity too. Ambonnay is also a very, very interesting sort of crew. It's very, very neutral. You tend to find a lot of the Grand Marks blend Ambonnay in to complement between very acidic sort of Chardonnay-based wines and the more structured sort of Verzinet sort of Pinot Noir wines. It is that neutral middle ground, and, you know, it always is. And it's interesting, you know, and we probably will see this a little more with the Aigle as well. It has that roundness. It has that real sort of pear fruit, that real, you know, mouth filling and mouth coating texture. But again, it doesn't necessarily have the attack and length and linearity of say, a Lude or a Montagne Durance. It is more mouth filling and broader on the palate. But to your point, yes, I would probably drink the Ambonnet right now, because that cruise really lends itself to some more short-termism, particularly in a bottle format. Sorry, and you do feel free to interrupt me. I do get very caught up and passionate about these wines, so I can tend to sort of go on a little bit. So you feel free to give me a kick and interrupt me.
We'll do, Rajiv.
Do we did we skip to the Aigle yet, or I guess you guys, it's five glasses of champagne. There's no way you're not going to touch any of them, really, you know.
Yeah, we already have the Aigle, so we can also talk about that too.
Yeah, let's talk about. So we have two vintages in front of us. I believe we have the 2004, which I'm not sure the disgorgement, but I mean that's likely to have been disgorged maybe around 2012, 2013. That's in a Magnum format, which is our only Magnum today. And then we have the 2012. So very quickly, the Aigle style. So, you know, very much what I call the second generation of growers behind the Solosses and the Vilmars. But again, probably now sort of behind the third generation, which is now appearing. Very much also, you know, a man passionate about sight, particularly about Ambonnet itself. There's a little bit of comedy in terms of my relationship with Francis. I tried to see him two times in 2007 and 2009, and both times he had problems with his children at school, and I missed him at the domain. So I didn't catch up to him until the first time in 2011. And I think what struck me then was his passion, first and foremost, but the way he embraced oak. And, you know, not just in the normal sense, you know, a lot of people ferment in oak, but he also sort of does a little bit of aging in oak too. And, you know, and that really sort of highlights his style. And, you know, when we look at his vintage wine, I always felt his vintage wine probably suffered a little bit in the reputation and behind the, you know, the VLV Blanc de Noir that he used to produce, and also some of his Meunier and other plots. But I think in the last, probably since the 2008 vintage, and, you know, William Kelly gave that wine 100 points, and hence prices have now increased. He's put real focus onto those plots, you know, and it's one that's coming very much into its own. Again, dosage is very low at 2 grams per litre. 2012 and 2004 are interesting contrasts of vintages. So 2004 was a very precocious vintage. The vines were absolutely unbelievable in their activity. I mean, people were green harvesting back to 10,000 kilograms, and then there would be more bud break and there would be more grapes appearing on the vines. You literally could not control the monster. That was a little bit to do with the 2003 phenomena. So in 2003, there was massive triage, very, very low yields, heat stress, water stress. We had a lot of droughts here in Europe. And so what happened was there were very few grapes to harvest, and what the vines kept on photosynthesizing until very late in the year. So what that meant was that there was a carbohydrate built up in the vines, in the root stock. And so 2004 actually leveraged the heat of 2003. So your 2004 character, that is that fluffy, light phenolic sort of character early on, and then this quite balanced acidic, and then sort of fruity flavors and then toasty flavors which develop later on, are thanks to the 2003 phenomena. You know, it's a vintage made the year before. 2012 has a similar sort of concentration with low yield. So this was post-financial crisis, where the Champenoise were told to control their yields by the CIVC. So there's a lot of green harvesting and pruning to get the yields down around 10,000 kilograms, I believe, per hectare. And so the... you know, whereas the and there was also a lot of stress as well. So for different reasons, there was also some frost stress as well in 2012. So the yields were kept low artificially and naturally, you know, unlike 2008, where that was a little bit of a natural sort of triage yield. So the 2012, very precocious vintage, very concentrated, a lot of really upfront fruity aromas. And, you know, a wine that is easy to drink. But 2012s are uniformly excellent and a real superb vintage. So that's my intro for those wines. So tell me about what you think about the Aigle. I mean, I'm particularly interested in the Magnum format of the 2004. It's a wine I've not tried, the 2004 in that format. So that's going to be very interesting to taste.
A lot of interest in the 2004 Mag. And feels like a step up in terms of quality versus the first three.
Yeah.
In terms of winemaking. Yeah. I don't know if that's because it's a
I think when we talk about magnums, and you know, it's no mystery to all of us here, you know, probably as connoisseurs, that you know, bottles and magnums are chalk and cheese. You know, magnums tend to always be slightly more structured, fresher, and you know, and will age longer. I think champagne being fundamentally a reductive wine, and you know, with reductive winemaking, it spends a lot of time on lees in its autolysis, and you know, magnum format really, really pushes champagne almost to where it needs to be. So it would be actually be very interested if you tried an originally disgorged 2004 alongside that magnum. I think that would be very diagnostic, and maybe something we will try and do in the future, try and get some originally disgorged magnum and bottles of the same wine to compare. But I feel there's a little bit of winemaking there, a little bit of terroir, as you say, Michael, but I think it's probably fundamentally the format itself, which promotes freshness and complexity. Do we have any, I mean, I think the interesting comparison as well would be to the Beresh Ambonnet, the 16, just to see that crew, the sort of mid-palate generosity that you get with that crew, the rounded, more sort of apricot sort of generous orchard fruits as opposed to the stern orchard fruits of the Montagne. I mean, is that coming through? Is that translating? Sorry, I can't hear you guys if you're talking. I think so. I think 16 vintage is probably a little more fresher at the moment. I also think stylistically, Beresh may have a little bit more sort of focus on the citrus aroma. The dosage is slightly higher. Let me just check my notes. So that's Latourée in Ambonnet for the Beresh. So if I look at that site, so that's probably a little bit more southern facing, a bit more generosity and where it is, where I think Aigle tends to blend a lot of sites in. So you're going to find an aggregation of the vintage for Aigle, whereas Beresh is very site specific. And I know that site is very much has a lot of intensity, you know, and I can understand why. For Ambonnet, you know, it's more neutral, and on the Aigle, for Beresh, it has more intensity. So I can understand that distinction there. What do we think of the Magnum? I'm still sort of vicariously interested in how sort of that Magnum is tasting. Is it still fresh? Do we have some development in there?
There's still five more in the pack. So when you come to Hong Kong, you can try one. I think you all like the Magnum, right?
Yeah.
It's big thumbs up.
Yeah,
big thumbs up.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Oh,
superb, right?
Beautiful. Still a bit fresh, you know. Still
very fresh.
Yeah, still so fresh, but
I think still young. Magnum is still young. But yeah. Starting to develop that secondary.
The cake.
And you know, Magnums do that. I mean, it's invariably the bottles tend to be showier, you know, more flashy, more fleshy. But you know, the Magnums always keep something in reserve. You know, they are those long aging supermodels that never seem to sort of sort of lose it, you know. And with champagne, that is so it as well. And particularly the low dosage. I mean, you know, dosage and Maillard reactions are the friend of champagne. And the longer and slower that those happen in the bottle, the, you know, the quality of the aroma tends to be a little bit better. And, you know, I think that's sort of deceiving, you know, in terms of the format itself. But again, I think Magnum formats are something that I would like to explore with you further and compare those to bottles, you know, and even the Gero, if we can possibly do that, Michael. It's such a diagnostic thing to do next to each other. And maybe for the future, we will go there and just to see how instructive that can be.
Well, sounds like we have our next tasting lineup.
Indeed, we do. Guys, I don't know how you're looking. Do you want to look at the second flight yet, or do you want to enjoy the first flight a bit more?
We have the two Cedric Bouchards for.
Okay, so let's talk about Bouchard. So I always consider Cedric as a one of the new growers, but it's probably dating me in terms of that he's now very much established and in the second generation. Cedric probably for me was the first grower that really looked at plots as individuals, you know, far earlier than Lost probably did. You know, not just as a crew, as a village level, but as a plot level wine, you know. And he had his 111 approach, which is you know, single parcels, single varieties, single vintage, you know. And it's excellent and so thrilling to taste these wines and those individual expressions. Unfortunately, they've become rarer because of that, and you know, more expensive. So it is a real privilege for you guys to taste those wines there. Interesting sort of bit of background. So the Rosé de Jean, which is actually named after his Polish grandmother but spoken as French, you know, and he had a lot of love for his grandmother. And, you know, clearly that love for the way she sort of treats him, she was very kind and gentle, he used to say, but very sort of honest with him. And he said that's what really wanted to drive his winemaking, you know, into his wines. They are exceptionally low yields. As a rule of thumb, sparkling wines can take yields probably maybe two and a half times that of an ordinary sort of Burgundy or still plod. But Cedric's taken it the other way. You know, he's gone ultra low, 4,000 kilos per hectare, which is, you know, phenomenally low. I mean, even some of the super low plots don't even get close to that. So I think you have two wines. So the first pour, let me just check which ones they are. So it's the Rosé de Jean, which is the Creux d'Enfer, which is the Rosé de Saunier. So Saunier, so made by the crush method, crush, macerate, leave the skin contact with the red skins for, I think, 3 or 4 hours, and then bleed off the red wine and later. So Saunier, really meaning bleed off in French. You have a second wine, which is the Brut Nature, which is this mystery secret wine that Michael told me about. I'm as blind as you guys are to that. So this is a wine where we have no reveal of the grapes, of what's gone into that, of the vintage even, or what disgorgement it is. All I know is that it is a Brut Nature, which is without dosage. I think just to close off the summary on Cedric. So the important thing for me is how his style is defined. I don't necessarily agree with him, but he thinks that you should, and he's a little bit with Solos on this, where you should make a still wine first and a sparkling wine second. And he feels that sparkling and the bubble method that gets in the way of his aromas. I don't necessarily agree with that in champagne in general, but you have to say whatever he does, the wines are absolutely fantastic and they age too, but the amount of autolysis is minimal. I mean, 15 to 18 months on yeast, the minimum he can get away with. So we have fruit to the fore. We have a real sort of smart oak style. So this is the southern part of Champagne, so it is very ripe. But yet they age with finesse and complexity, and they never really lose their freshness. And you know, I cry a little bit when I look at the market prices, because there are wines in the past which I've loved to buy and age, you know, but it's going to be harder for us to do that in the future. So, you know, guys, enjoy the privilege of trying these wines. So I hand over to the table. What do we think of the first two wines?
Steve, I think there's a bit of maybe these are too young. Obviously, he's only arrived from the import like 6 months ago. Okay. But the problem is, you only get a bottle from the importer these days. Super rare cuvées. So I think, you know, tasting the two, people like Seba.
Do you know how much they produce?
No, very small production.
300, 500.
I don't know, Steve. Of the rosé, how many bottles does he produce?
I think it's just a couple of thousand, maybe a few thousand at the most. Production varies year on year, but that tends to be the average. For the mystery cuvée, I have no idea what it is or what the production level is. You can guarantee it's going to probably number in the hundreds of bottles. So you have the 2018 vintage there, is that correct? So the 2018 is the first one of a warm sequence of vintages we had. So if we look at 2017, it was a very good Chardonnay year, but a cooler year. Pinot Noir suffered a lot of botrytis, a lot of rot, oidium and mildew, whereas 18 was a warm grown cycle, the first one of three. So we have the 18, 19, 20 trilogy. 18 probably suffered a small amount of heat stress. So there are a lot of high yield. very warm year, but I think the heat came in during the crucial period of varietal, which is when the color changes in the grapes, in the skin of the grapes. It's when the skins thicken. It's when the sort of acidity starts being digested by enzymes, and the ripeness occurs aromatically. So you want cool sort of evenings for that. And because of the vegetative cycle is so early now, early August, it's sort of, you know, an early August where varietal starts to happen. We're not getting those cool nights. We're getting warm nights. So a lot of that enzymatic activity is getting very high. So a lot of acidity is being digested. So you're getting this combination of ripe, neutral fruit with some aromatic development, which is unusual for Champagne, or historically was unusual for Champagne. We're also not getting the phenolic ripeness that we used to have. So we're getting something that's a little bit lighter, still has some acidity, but tends to have still wine sort of flavors and aromas with very early discord Champagne. So on the 18, you know, with 18 months worth of lees aging, you're not going to get a lot of autolytic character. So you're going to get a lot of fruity, almost still wine character with that wine. And again, it's probably going to appear very young and neutral versus a Burgundy style. A lot of information there, guys. Sorry if I'm overloading you with information. I probably do encourage you to maybe watch the recording back. And also, I do have some precise note sets as well related to these wines, which I'm very happy to send the audience after here with some technical information in there. Yeah, is this the which one are we talking about here? The
number three.
Rosé.
I feel it's changing in the glass.
Rosé.
Yeah.
Rosé.
Yeah, so it's very hard to be precise because, you know, in vintage is also individual as well. And, you know, what I tend to do with all my champagnes at home is that, you know, I never look at a bottle and think I'm going to open this and leave this for 18, you know, 90 minutes or 2 hours. You know, it's probably one where if I'm there, I can finesse the decision a little bit. And, you know, quite often I will open the bottle, leave it in a very shallow ice bucket with some ice in there, and then have pause and then leave a little bit in the glass. And I think the important thing for me is that probably you are better if you can to leave wine in the glass than in the bottle. Let it warm up with the aerate, let it warm up with atmosphere. I think the problem you have is that if we did that for 15 wines here, you're going to have a very crowded sort of room, you know, and a very confusing table. And I fear for health and safety with what almost 300 pieces of stemware on your table. So I think it's a necessary evil for us. But yes, in hindsight, maybe it would be better to open that a little bit closer to the pour time. Do we also have the Solosses and the Provost also poured?
You guys open, right? So maybe we come back to it because I think there's still quite a bit in the bottle.
So yeah.
Okay. Fine. Fine.
Sure? What I think would be interesting is now that we're going into Provost, Raymond told me I need to find Provost. So I went out my way to the UK market, found some Provost cases and shipped them over.
Wow.
So this one is the rosé, right? And then we've got some Jacques Solosse and Guillaume. Maybe I'll pass to Steve on those three.
This is probably a little bit of a fireside chat with cigars and brandy. So let's start the story at the beginning. Let's talk about Jacques Solosse. So I think it is safely to say that almost single-handedly, maybe with a little bit of help of Vilmar, he started the craze for Gros Champagne. So, I mean, Gros as a thing have been around since the 1960s, 1970s. There's been a lot of production cellar door, but, you know, they've always been below the radar sort of production, historically very, very cheap for a lot of growers. I could tell you some prices I used to pay in the early 2000s for some of these growers, and you'd probably be crying into your napkins. So let me cheer you up and tell you the story of the Solosses. Jacques Solosse, Anselme Solosse inherited his domain. And I think then what was very clear to him, he wanted to do something that was a little bit more individual. So a lot of the growers were following the story of the Grand Marks. So at the time when growers became popular, a lot of stainless steel, sort of vat ferments, a lot of sites were getting blended into Grand Terroirs, so Côte de Blanc style or across Sapages. So what he wanted to do was take his mainly of these holdings and, you know, and do something a little bit different, something a little bit more artisanal. It's interesting to talk to Anselme. I mean, he's a character that's very divisive. And I will admit that over the years, I've seen him a few times And I scratched my head at some of his decisions in terms of, you know, why he wanted to do things. But what I would have to say, he's always been honest. And he's always said to me, you know, this is something that I never want to do in the scripted way, in a formulaic way. You know, he wants to make wines that are honest, not only to the site, to Champagne itself, but to himself, but also to the vintage too. And that's very important to understand. And, you know, he attracted a lot of attention. I mean, he had so many disciples, and one of those was Jerome Prévost. So Jerome is a little bit away from sort of the Côte de Blanc Saint-Avis, and he's a place called Gur and in Pinot Meunier country. And he had a lot of vines which for many years he inherited, but didn't feel he could make those best wines. So he sort of sold those grapes onto the Négociants and the Grand Marks. And then he was prompted by his mom, just said, hey, one day, go follow your passions, go make your wines. And, you know, and Jerome is very much, you know, since the 1980s doing that. You know, he's following his passions as an artiste. You know, he was a disciple of Silos, so follows very similar to winemaking philosophies. A lot of oak, a lot of individuality, sort of low sulfur across the board. Although Anselmi Silos sort of uses a little bit more sulfur at appropriate times, and we'll talk a little bit that. I mean, I think 2005 is very important to talk about, and SO2, and then finally we have Guillaume Silos, so the son of Anselm. So he passed the baton to his son, and you know, a lot of people were saying, hey, it's a change of a generation. What's going to happen to the domain of Jacques? But I think it's in very, very safe hands, you know. And there's a very interesting evolution and revolution going on as well. So we thought that Jacques probably invented the book on individuality. I think it's safe to say that Guillaume, since 2012, you know, by buying vines in, and the wine that we have here is by bought in vines from the Aube, he's doing his own thing too. And I think what he will do, he will take the domain of Jacques Silos and he will finesse it and put some individuality on there. So let's start with the Prévost then, which I think is the first pour. So I think we have another rosé. Not clear what the lot is on here, LC13. So I'm not sure if that's the 13 based vintage or if it's the 13 bottled, which would be the 12 based. But again, Prévost has a lot of the umami sort of mouthfeel, a lot of savory character, a little bit of red fruit roundedness, but a lot of power extracted from oxidative sort of character, you know. And and the Meunier, of course, has that very sort of flowery finesse when young, and that very meaty savory style when it sort of starts to pick up some age. So I'll let you guys taste the Prévost first of all. Do you want to give some quick feedback before we go to the Silos's?
So when you look at Jacques Silos, the 2005, and then Guillaume Silos, Guillaume has taken over since 2012, is that right?
He has, but not the Jacques Silos domain. So I think it's around maybe the last 3 or 4 years he's had domain in Jacques Silos. So originally, I have some interesting facts here. So the Largier is actually made from Aube fruits, and so nothing to do with the Côte de Blanc. So a very, very different style. As I say, very, very ripe from a parcel called the Corsin parcel from a guy called Jerome Corsin. Who owns a large 3.3 hectare monopole in the center of the village. You know, it's very much 100% Pinot Noir in style, 45-year-old vines. It's a southern exposure on an all very warm climate. And it's clay limestone. So clay limestone tends to sort of exaggerate power and fruit, and being Pinot Noir as well, southern exposure and ripeness. Whereas the Silos is Chardonnay, is from Avize, so a flinty, sometimes apple fruit style, and you know, and a not a lot older vintage as well. And I think there's a bit of a difference in the, you know, the aging. So Silos has a lot of bottle aging there as well.
Steve, what's the grape composition of the number nine, the Jacques Salot, 2005?
So it's 100% Aviz and Chardonnay fruit. So it's a Blanc de Blanc for all intents and purposes. The individual plots I can tell you here are the Mont de Cramont and the Chantarenne in Aviz. So if you imagine Aviz has it's quite a lot of slopes heading down towards the southern part of the Côte de Blanc. And you get a lot of chalk in the midsection. There's a lot of clay and accumulation at the bottom and a lot of shallow soils at the top. So the 2005 vintage was very, very interesting. So a little bit difficult on all grape varieties. So we had a lot of botrytis in there. So if you've tried sort of Dom Perignon and other styles, there is a very botrytis style in the Champagne. So a lot of that bitter apricot aroma that you get on the finish from the gluconic acid that you get from that noble rot. In 2005 as well, so Salos normally would not use any sulfur in his winemaking, or very little, but because of the botrytis threat, he actually added some sulfur dioxide into the winemaking. So he protected against botrytis, first of all, but actually an unintended consequence. He actually protected the wine from a little bit of oxidation. So I'm finding the 2005 a little more fresher than some of his other wines, and probably a little bit fresher than Pinot Noirs from later vintages too.
Sorry, Steve. Sorry, just going back to the Provost. Is it 100% Pinot Meunier?
Yeah, it is indeed. Yes. Yep. The Provost is yes. Yep.
Very impressive to do a Pinot Meunier Rosé 100% like that and this quality.
Are we looking for the bouquet? So the last time I tasted this, probably 5 years ago or 4 years ago, it may have even been a pre-ISA release sampling. I can't remember when I tasted it. But it was very, very fresh style. So it is very much that salty umami style, isn't it? It's very much food related, interesting bouquet and aromatic nuances as well. Meunier is an underrated variety. We incorrectly call it Pinot Meunier. It's actually sort of Meunier is not Pinot. First of all, it's halfway between the two. It's actually a clone of its own. And it's an interesting mid-palate richness. I mean, Pinot Noir tends to dominate the finish and have a little bit of an attack. Chardonnay is the other way around, where Meunier seems to be very quiet on the finish and the attack. So you have to rely on winemaking that to fill in those gaps. But mid-palate strength, the Meunier is second to none. I have to stop calling it Pinot Meunier. I will get violently attacked by various Champenoirs if I keep doing it.
Guillaume Salos,
yes,
does not seem as impressive as the Jacques Salos. Stylistically, similarities.
Yeah, later, 2015 based vintage. I think the latest one is. I don't know if you can confirm from the back of the bottle that is the one you have, which is a 2019 or 20 disgorgement.
Let us check.
Okay. And you know, bottle age is everything. I mean, you know, I had a conversation with Richard Geoffroy of Dom Perignon when he released it in 2008, and I said to him, "What would you have?" Because you know they concentrate on their Enotech, their long lees aging, and I said, "What would you have? Long lees aging recently disgorged, or would you have less lees aging and originally disgorged with more bottle age?" And he said, "It's always the latter." He said, "You know, as much as I love autolysis and how it suits the reductive style of Dom Perignon, you know, bottle age is the friend of champagne. You know, well-stored bottles are thrilling, you know, and there's that fine balance, isn't there, between bottle age and autolysis. And I think the Salos has probably had that time in the bottle where it really, you know, and I'll be honest, I'm not a fan of all of Salos's wines. I find a lot of them far too savoury and oxidated for my palate, but you know, the 2005 is one that really that does appeal, you know, and one of his success stories, you know, and I can see why that probably belittles the Sun's attempt with different fruit. And I think we've got terroir at play here. I mean, Aviz is a grand terroir, you know, it's Chardonnay. 2005 is probably a better vintage for Chardonnay than it was for Pinot Noir, whereas 2019 is a very ripe. And a very recent, 2015 is a ripe and very recent vintage and suffers from a little bit of greenness as well. So heat stress in 2015 means that the vine shut down in that crucial veraison. So a lot of the acids are still green. So you have aromatic sort of ripeness and almost fruit ripeness, but you have this green sort of acidity which dominates the finish. And it's a very strange vintage and a hard one to work. There are not many vintages which have grows which have succeeded in that vintage, even though the weather was stunning. Again, a lot of information I've piled in there, and I do encourage you, if you want to go back over and watch the recording. And I'm happy to write this stuff down too. If you have any special requests for future articles, you know, I'm very happy to accommodate them with this sort of information too.
I would like to ask, is it that the son and father, is it use the same vineyard or different vineyard for the Celos?
So it's interesting. So I'm not sure how this is going to play out in the long term. So it's not been revealed how they will evolve this going in the future. But for the examples that you have here, so Guillaume sort of did his own sort of route. So he didn't have access of the father's domain. So you know that Celos bought a lot of plots in IE and other Grand Crus, not just for Pinot Noir, but for Chardonnay too. And so the son sort of had to buy in and negotiate the plot. So for the one that you have here, it's from the Aube. The gentleman is called Jérôme Kerson. It's in the Ville-sur-Arc, and it's in the south of the part of Champagne. So there's a lot of clay soils there. There's a lot of, I think this Kimmeridgian soil, I think, was also here, which is very similar to Chablis too. Whereas in Avize, there's a lot of flints, there's a lot of belemnite and other sort of small chalky aspects as well, with different depths of topsoil. So for the Celos and Avize, Chardonnay versus the Pinot Noir and the bright southern fruit of the Guillaume.
So one more question. For the Scotchman Day is 2017, right? So there are a lot of vintage. Is it a single vintage or three vintage mixed together?
I think there is, let me just show you. I think there's a little bit of reserve wine now in there. It used to be single vintage. I know he mentioned that he may build up a little bit of reserve wine, but I don't think there's a lot, even if there is. I think you're going to pretty much get vintage dominating there. So that was a 2017 disgorgement. So I'm guessing that's, can we check if the bottle mentions if the base wine's 2013 maybe or 14?
Do we know?
Okay.
12, okay. So interesting. So the 12 is a very concentrated vintage. Now, 2012 in the Aube was actually quite a difficult vintage. I mean, we talk about it being a great and grand vintage for Champagne, but the Aube, a lot of problem with frost, a lot of problem with hail, very low yields, and so probably a little more difficult than it was maybe for the north of Champagne and the Côte de Blanc, Montendurant, and the Grand Valais, you know.
Okay. Single vintage. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. I do believe he may be pushing for some of the, but I will check that for you. So Loss is a very interesting character, and some of his winemaker decisions I've never really understood, because he almost appears to be trying to make Burgundy and then putting bubbles in afterwards, and then having long lees aging, which is slightly contradictory. Having said that, that's probably my lack of understanding, if I'm honest, as much as anything, because, you know, I always said to him, look, I open three of your bottles, they're the same wine, same disgorgement, and one wine will be oxidative, one wine will be fresh, and another wine will be somewhere in the middle. You know, how do you feel about that? You know, as a connoisseur buying a product, it concerns me the variability. And he said, look, I'm making individual bottles here. You know, these are characters. No wine is perfect in the vineyard. No vinification is perfect, and no bottle or cork is perfect. You know, he said, even for me, the cork in itself has an individual contribution to make to the characteristic. And if that means it becomes too oxidative, so be it. He said, if that means that it's too reductive, so be it. So it's a very, very hard to nail down. I have to say the best wines from Celos are very chiseled, very, very intense. You know, it's that weightless intensity that we look in the best wines. Some of the wines I find frustrating. You know, some of my very expensive bottles of wine have been very oxidized, and it's not a style I enjoy as easy as the next person, and have been frustrating. So honestly, he's a frustrating yet brilliant character, and I think he would probably smile if i if I mention that Anselmi, you're this person, he would probably agree. He said, yeah, I am frustrating. People are, you know. I mean, there's an interesting, so 2005, you know, as a vintage was challenging. So, as I said, to protect against the botrytis and other issues that they had in the ear, he used a lot of sulfur at pressing. And, you know, sulfur dioxide not only protects the wine from oxidation of alcohol, but it, you know, it also, and its chief usage is a preservative. I mean, if any of you have had sort of dried fruit, you know, raisins and other things, there is so much sulfur dioxide, free sulfur added to protect from oxidation. You know, and I have friends who go on these health kicks and they won't touch wines because they say they're full of sulfites. And yet they will be putting half a bag of raisins on their fruit in the morning, you know. And I say, look, you know, you've just added the equivalent of three magnums of my favorite champagne on one of your breakfasts in terms of the amount of sulfur. Pass me the champagne. You stick to your fruit, you know. So, and, you know, it's not an evil. Sulfur is not an evil. But I understand for Solos, he doesn't want to be his wines defined by reductiveness, free sulfur, and those other things. But he also doesn't want his wines to be defined by botrytis and other evils and beasties. So, you know, in terms of bacterial, biological spoilage. So he does the right thing for him, which is he finds the right level. His oxidation doesn't concern him, but botrytis and disease did. And so that's what he did with 2005.
So, Steve, we're now having the Eau de Seine Colin being served, and the immediate comment that came around was like, wow,
impressive. Say, of all of these growers today, I love my Bereshes, I love my Aiglis. Solosses, I have a love-hate relationship with Provost, but for Ulysse Colin, wow, indeed. And what can I say? I mean, based in the not-so-great terroir of Congy in the northern Coteau de Cézanne. So the Cézanne occupies this sort of space between the very warm and ripe fruit of the Aube. It's below the Grand Crus of Montandurand, Grand Valais de la Marne, and the Côte des Blancs. The fruit is, and it's fruit. I mean, when we talk about the area, let's talk about fruit, you know. It's a little south of Vertus on the Côte des Blancs, and about 30 kilometers south of Epinay. You know, he had a lot of his family's vines rented out to a large mark. I think it used to go into Cristal and some Dom Perignon up until 2003. The vines weren't in great shape. No disrespect to his forebears or the people who used to look after his vines, but I think they used very brutal yield orientated sort of cropping methods, and he embraced the vines very much, you know, very much focused on organics and vineyard maintenance. Now he was also studied sort of law for eight years as well, which gives a very interesting slant on the way he approaches his winemaking. He's very precise. Again, he uses very minimal sulfur. He uses hand harvesting, of course, as most of Champagne does. The clusters are fully destemmed. Grapes very gently pressed, so you have a lot of grape expression, not a lot of stem expression as you do with some areas. And he doesn't use any fining or filtering. And he likes to disgorge during February. One of the strange parts of Champagne is that everybody likes to disgorge their wines after assemblage, which is May or June, which is very hot in Champagne. So he does a very sensible thing. Do in February, there's very, very low issue with temperatures. It means that oxidative behavior is very, very low. The yeast is also very calm in the bottles as well when you bring them up to the surface. And, you know, again, he does what Solos began and others do. He very much focuses on plot. And, wow, I mean, I know we reserve probably for now for the Zoom, but I'm happy to wait for another sort of 30 or 40 minutes if you guys still want to chat. Let's talk about what we have. I mean, we have Le Melon, which is on the Côte de Cézanne, which is a 100% Pinot Noir on a 2.5-hectare plot. 50-year-old vines, iron-rich clay over chalk soil. Then the Les Enfers, which is 75% 2016, 25% 2015 wine, which is 100% Chardonnay. So again, 0.62 hectare UD, 45-year-old vines, Eastern exposure for this, and clay and silex topsoils over limestone. The interesting one, which is Le Jardin de Ulysse, which is a pure 2016, a Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier, and Pinot Noir, in Congy as well, so sharing a little similarity to the previous wine. And then we have Le Roise, which is a very unusual vineyard, very specific geology here, which is clay and silex over limestone too, but also has a strict southern exposure, and that makes a hell of a difference with certain vintages. And, you know, looking again, this is also a blend, 75% 2016, 25% 2015. So I think the triage of cépage is for 2016 is the only one we have there. And the last two wines are also sort of Chardonnay, so a good cross-section of the cépage. So I'll hand over to the floor. I can talk about this guy all day. Again, I am a little bit sort of having to mop up the tears off the floor using a large mop, because the wines are not as cheap as they used to be. And, they are in the collector's sort of regime in terms of pricing, you know, very strict connoisseur level, and justly so. These guys work a lot for what they do, and it should be no longer the merchants and then the negotiants in the middle who make the profit. You know, these guys fully deserve to make their money. So happy that this guy is now receiving the prestige he deserves. Let me hand it over to the floor. I finished my speech and happy to sort of let you taste and feel questions.
Sorry, there's an intense discussion going between 11 and 12 at the moment.
Okay.
But there's a feeling that there's a very good quality of wines that are being poured at the moment.
Yeah, so sometimes the recipes, I mean, I looked at certain growers and, you know, like Solos and some of the recipes that they use in terms of their winemaking technique. Let's not have any avoidance of the true message here. You know, wine is a technical champagne. It is made in a technical way using a technical process and always will be. It's two fermentations. It has different vats involved, you know, different ways of training the three different grape varieties that you have. Massive difference in terms of terroirs. Difference in the way you can use dosage, you can use oak, you can use stainless steel. You know, the dynamics are impressively massive. And, you know, in certain one of those dynamics, so, you know, in terms of fining and filtering, so the avoidance of that sometimes leads to heavy, soupy wines that are prone to oxidation, because what you have is a wine that has a lot of spent or consumed phenol compounds, and that actually encourages oxidation and promotes oxidation and heaviness in aged wines. But for Olivier, I think what he does is finesse all of his winemaking. You know, so precise, that law making sort of degree that he has, and his you know approach to it, it comes through in his wines, so clear. And you know, I think to look to growers like Jean-Paul Ebra up in Marais, and he does the same. You know, that same precise attention to detail, and really comes on his wines. You know, the passion's there, but also the intensity in terms of the way he approaches it.
Steve. So a bunch of guys when they had the number 13 pour,
yep.
Le Jardin de Ulysse, that impressed a lot of people. But you can tell the quality of all across the board. There's some people who still really like the Maillon 15.
Yep.
Enfers, obviously, also great, but the Le Jardin de Ulysse is really top. Is it very small production, you think?
Yeah, very small production, parcel level. I mean, if you look at the number of hectares on there, you know, you're talking a couple of thousand bottles max per each of these cuvées. And, you know, I think Champagne's an interesting region when you look versus sort of Burgundy or Bordeaux. Some of the smallest plots in Champagne are minute, you know. And I look to even, you know, big wines that we saw, you know, Clos de Guasse by Philippinat. And there's less than 20,000 bottles equivalent made in the vintage, which if you look compared to, you know, Moët & Chandon, who probably make more sort of Brut Imperial than maybe the rest of Champagne put together their non-vintage output, you know, it's small. And then you go down again to the growers. So, yes, I think some of these parcels numbering at the very minimum thousands. I think maybe one of them is 3,500. I do have some backup notes somewhere else on my laptop with production numbers. And what I will do, let me add them to the notes here that I have on the breakdown, and I'll send this spreadsheet to you guys for your consumption after the event.
And Steve, do you think the 48 months to the 60 months... It seems to make a difference. I mean, we have the Boisés being poured at the moment.
Yep.
But just like to get your thoughts on why they decided to take that one extra year, what to do, because they do still release to the market both, right? And, you know, what's the logic of that?
So, I mean, this, you know, the, let's look at Champagne. So first of all, it's constraint. You know, stock is everything. It costs money to hold stock in Champagne. You know, it's not like Burgundy or Bordeaux where you hold bottles for 18 months and then release after the harvest. You know, when you have a 2016 base vintage, they've been in your cellars for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you know. That costs money in terms of sunk costs. You've already sunk costs in into your sort of production, and now you can't realize and realize that margin until you release. You know, the accountants amongst you will probably appreciate the level of inventory costs that would have for domains. Secondly, there are considerations in the way disgorgements work, and disgorgements are not a linear thing. You know, you can have more recent disgorgements which can taste older than earlier disgorgements, and that's down to the behavior of yeast and consumption of oxygen while on yeast, and that can actually differ between bottle formats, between grapes, and between sort of even in between sort of oak and stainless steel. And you know, that's another excellent sort of topic for a future shall we call it, and I call myself this a geeky look into to yeast autolysis. So I think the second consideration is the second one. I think the third consideration as well, and this is the chief one, what works for the growers. I mean, I know that Olivier and other growers, they have sample disgorgements every 6 months. They take a disgorgement. Is this wine ready? And some growers, and I'm not sure Olivier does that. I know he's done this in the past when he didn't have so much pressure on stock. They won't release a wine if it's not ready. You know, they test these wines, they add a dosage, they leave it 3 weeks and they say, hey, is this wine ready for general release? No, I'll hold the wines back for another period. And I think this may be an example of that, you know, attention to quality. The wine's not ready, don't release it. And I think a comment on the, you know, in terms of the age of yeast autolysis for growers, and I think unless you're a guy like Egli who likes to experiment with long yeast aging, for guy like Olivier and others, 48 to 60 months is that sweet period. For me, you've got the right comparison between the fruit estuary sort of character and you've got the yeast autolysis character as well. And then look at the release date. So all of these have been released with just over 18 months post-disgorgement aging, you know. And even if you use very minimal sulfur dioxide at disgorgement, you know, that is the happy period, 12 to 18 months, even for generic non-vintage champagnes you'll buy from a supermarket, for example. Give them 12 to 18 months post-disgorgement, and the uptick in aromas, particularly for, and I will use original cork and non-jetted disgorgement wines, is incredible. If we talk about jetting and DM closure, I think that's a whole new ball game in terms we have to give a little bit longer for those. But I know that Olivier doesn't use that. So, yeah, definitely 18 months post-disgorgement has really allowed for that aromatic uptick. And if any of you know the film with, I forget the film about the band, you know, and then they had this... they had this amplifier and they had 1 to 10 and then they have number 11, you know, just to turn up to. I think very much the 18 months for Olivier is the happy period. Turn the amplifier up to number 11 on a 10 number scale. And intensity, fruit, always in a more fresh style, but not without sort of weight, not without sort of some savouriness, but it's volume on the palate. It really is that real expression intensity of fruit.
We're now tasting the 14 versus the 15.
Okay. I think there's March 21 disgorgement and a February 22 disgorgement you have. So again, almost all these ones will be disgorged during February and March. So there'll be a year apart from these. So if we talk about the vintage character, so the 14 versus 15 versus 16 vintage characters. 14 is a very good Chardonnay vintage. Again, you're probably going to find that wine number 14 is showing a little bit better there. 15 is a good Chardonnay vintage, a bit more ripe than the cooler 14. Has a little bit of that acidity on the finish, that greenness that I was on about from the heat stress that the vine suffered. And 16 is probably somewhere between the two. It's a little bit more ripeness than 14, but less ripe than 15. And quality is pretty aggregate, aggregately good in across the board in terms of ripeness and quality. 15 Pinot Noir is probably more successful than 15 Chardonnay, I would suggest. So you like the Côte de Sazan, then it's something that's hitting the spot. So it's in bottle. So if we look at the vinification process, so spontaneous ferments. So again, something that happens naturally rather than added yeasts, and very slowly for first fermentation. So again, going against the recipe normally for champagne, which is a fast and hard first fermentation, natural yeast and bottle that filtering or fining, and then aged very short time in barrel before being assembled after 1 year. So if you look at sort of the 2015 base, which would have been bottled in 16 and then was disgorged in 21. So that's about 60 months. So we don't have a lot of barrel aging here. So we have a lot of barrel fermenting, first fermentation. So the age of wine number 14 or the expression is coming with post-disgorgement bottle aromas. And, because of the low dosage, because of the low sulfur regime, you're going to very, very quickly get that uptick in aromas. You know, the evolution is going to be faster, medium term for these wines. So, even a year will make a big difference. So wine number 15 was only disgorged 15 months ago, whereas wine number 14 was disgorged, I think, about 26 months ago. So you can see it makes a hell of a difference. I'm not clear what the import to regime. So importers for you guys have a lot of power, because you guys buy the wine from them. So the growers are very happy to accommodate you. In Europe, we tend to get more of an aggregated importer policy. So the wines here tend to be very much 48 to 60 months. So I know some growers keep back library stock. So it may be that your importer sort of flexed his financial muscles and said, hey, we'd like to sort of take some wines with some longer aging. And I think for the Asian palate versus the English palate. So the English palate is sort of the Grand Glaze, which is the freshest tasting old champagne, as Tom Stevenson used to call it. And I think for the Asian palate is more for the savory characters, the salty umami, the real big expression of fruit and oak and yeast intensity. So I think for the longer aging is probably why those went to your market as opposed to Europe. You guys are having too much fun. You're doing too much drinking, not enough talking and asking questions. This is going to be banned from the next Zoom. I'm going to cut down to five wines and then have a very sort of English and stable environment.
I think we've clearly pivoted to drinking now.
Absolutely.
Any last questions for Steve? Otherwise, we let him go and enjoy his.
What's his favorite?
Oh, okay. Of all the producers,
I'll tell you what I'll do. If you guys are in the drinking mode, if you can give me just 2 minutes, let me crack open something. I haven't got anything that you guys have got there myself. And let's have a 15-20 minute question round robin. If you guys have got the time, I certainly have the time to spare, and you can ask some questions. We can just have a chat. Does that work for you?
Sure. No problem.
Okay, give me 5 minutes and I'll get something in the glass. So I've gone very pedestrian. So I had a sample from Maison Charles Heidsieck for the 2017 based Brut Reserve, which is a wine I haven't tasted yet, and I had it freshly chilled. So first of all,
can you hold up the bottle, Steve?
Yes.
Oh. Cheers. Hi, good man.
Cheers, you're very good health. Thank you.
Charles Heinzek does some really good wines.
I do indeed. So I'm sorry it's not in the spirit of what we're tasting here, but it's the only one I have chilled with me, and I've been promising to taste the sample for a while, but it's based upon the 2017 vintage, which was not a great vintage for Champagne, good for Chardonnay, not so good for Pinot Noir. It's a blender's vintage. So guys like Charles Heidsieck, so they now have reserve wines in oak. They do a lot of stainless steel reserve wines. They are blenders extraordinaire. And I have to say, this is very nice indeed. And, you know, they've embraced climate change. They've gone with this reserve wine philosophy where they have fresher stainless steel wines to complement their condiment wines, as I would call them, which are the oak-aged reserve wines, which are the salt and pepper to add to the dish. And it's a little bit cold yet, but I'm getting the really fine lemony toast aromas and a little bit of vanilla nuance from the oak, but only very, very small. And that fine crystalline sort of aromatics, it's very, very fresh, very young.
So Steve, on that comment, I mean, the Solano 7 should be a fantastic wine, right?
I am. Very good indeed. Solon is a winemaker I get a little bit frustrated with in terms of their winemaking. Some of their winemaking is quite oxidative, even though they're very reductive. So what I mean by that is they're reductive up until disgorgement. Then they don't add any sulfur at disgorgement, so it becomes very oxidative in bottle. So it tends to have a shorter curve for some vintages. Having said that, it's all about balance and phenolics. So if I look at Salon, I would always look at cooler years. So 7 is a great Chardonnay vintage. It's a cooler year as well. Same as 2008. I mean, that's another great vintage for Salon. Magnums of Salon are to die for still. I have no doubt about that. I have a couple of magnums of 2007 lying somewhere around here, which are desperately need me for not to look at the market price, but to sort of close my eyes and open one day. And 2007 Salon, I actually think may surpass the 08 Salon. I'm going to call that one out because 07 Chardonnay is just so good.
So what about 06, 04, 02? You said cooler vintage is better.
Yeah. So let's, excuse me, just grab my glass here. So 2002 is a very interesting vintage. It's a vintage where on paper it was classic. At the time when we tasted the wines, they were extremely excellent. What marks 2002 is something called passerellage. It's a north drying wind, which dehydrates the grapes on the vine. So what that happens is that the moisture content of the grapes drops, and the phenol content, the dry extract, the acidities and all of those other things increases exponentially. So the must weights, I think we're off the charts for 2002. And, you know, when we tasted these wines, I mean, some of the wines almost tasted at Van Clare level, and were like raisin, you know, raisin juice. They were tasted so mature, apricot, almost like a straw wine from Italy. And I think that misled certain people to think it was a super vintage, aromatically very mature, very weighted in the mouth. I mean, high alcohol levels. And so it's hyper-concentrated, and that unfortunately has led to some oxidative tendencies. And I think we see this in 02 Dom Perignon, and, you know, I've given that quite an ugly score. When you see the report coming out, I'll reveal to you, because the Chardonnay is just too mature and hyper-concentrated. And I fear that 02 Salon may suffer from that in the long term. I think in the medium term, you know, you're going to get some good progression in terms of evolution. But if oily viscosity, mature Chardonnay is your thing, you know, that real sort of oily, you know, almost like walnut oil mouthfeel is your thing, it's going to hit your bag, you know. And that's not for me, but for you guys, you know, that may be more up your street. 04, I think, is a sleeper vintage. As again, I've discussed the 03 effect of giving carbohydrate to the vines has meant that 04 is a very precocious vintage, quite balanced, very pretty, very charming vintage. It's going to age very well in bottle and superbly in Magnum. 06 is somewhere between the two. 06 Chardonnay is a little bit difficult. Again, it has a propensity towards maturity. 06 Dom Perignon and other wines show that as well. 06 Comte de Champagne also was an excellent wine, but it was also showing that walnut oil sort of mid-palate, which is a signature of maturing Chardonnay. There's no doubt Salon will go the same way. And again, I implore you always for Champagne, if you can afford it, you know, sell the house, sell the wife, sell the kids, get Magnums always, you know.
Wait, Steve, so always go Magnums over bottles, right?
Always Magnum over bottles. Magnums will be short and thrilling. Magnums will always be class, will always be fresher, invariably. And, you know, I have, there's something which I call the 4-3-2-1 rule. You know, four out of every 10 Magnums are always far better. Three out of every 10 are much better. Two out of every 10 are at least as good. Only one out of 10 is poorer than the bottle. You know, that's always the rule of thumb for me. And, you know, and I'd rather buy one Magnum than three bottles, you know, every time. Do you guys have any other questions?
Steve. 2012 versus 2013.
Wow. 2012. So what a vintage. Homogeneity in champagne is something that doesn't really exist. You know, we forget that if I sort of start driving from the north and drive to the south on, you know, driving at the maximum speed limit that I can, it would still take me 2.5 hours to get to the bottom of champagne. So, you know, weather conditions are everything. So 2012 was probably more of a uniform vintage than 13, although there were some local issues with Chardonnays. For example, up in Cramont and Chouilly in the north of Côte de Blanc, a lot of triage with frost and hail meant that the vintage was probably not as good as it could have been in other areas of 2012. But, you know, a lot of there was a lot of triage in terms of green harvesting, but also sort of frost damage to the vine. So an unnatural density. So natural, you know, where did you get a natural density through 2008, where long hang time, so the grapes on 103 days on average, I think, it gives a real long sort of phenolic input into the grapes. 2012 had a little bit short on hang time, but more of a phenolic input from vine and precocity, you know, and that's because of the lower yields. So 2012, a Pinot Noir, excellent. Chardonnay is also very good, and so is Meunier, but I think it is a Pinot Noir vintage. Blends have come across very good, a very easy vintage to like, you know, a lot of ripeness and good acidity too. But, you know, harvest time was very early in September, and so probably Veraison was in a warmer period. So you get that with a little bit of more of those fluffy sort of vintage character. Good potential though too. I mean, it's one of those vintages that's flattering to deceive. So a lot of early aromatics, you know, ripeness, easy to like, pretty flowery sort of aromas. But there is some dry extract lurking underneath that will develop very well. And as those early aromas drop out, that dry extract will reappear and really anchor that long-term aging. 2013 was also a ripe vintage, oddly enough, but also was a late vintage. I mean, historically, we have to go back to the 1990s to get a vintage which started in late September and finished in October. Probably the last October vintage of the 21st century that we will ever see. I mean, I'm unlikely to see that ever again. We can talk about acidity. Acidity is a major feature. Veraison happened very, very late. It's a very cool summer, so you get a lot of acidity in 2013. And it's good, cool acidity. So you have malic acid, but you also have a ripe tartaric element as well. And that's because of the long hang time, a good Veraison, a good enzymatic maturity in the vines, but also some preservation from the cool nights of that acidity too. And, you know, the phenolics are off the chart. I mean, 2013 is just superb. I mean, there's so much intensity there. It's a very interesting vintage in terms of terroirs, whereas 2012, there are nuances across the board. 2013 has very individual, almost exaggerated terroirs. I mean, terroirs came to the fore in that vintage. So for Côte de Blanc, it is classic cool with great acidity. 2013 on the northern Montagne de Lens, so it's sort of Lude, Verzy, Verzenay, Mailly, Grand Cru. Again, another cool vintage with a lot of acidity, a lot of dry extract, very, very lot of pear characters, a lot of that real sort of neutral and mouth-watering intensity. Ambonnay on the south, oddly enough, was a very ripe vintage. A lot of orchard fruits, apple-y fragrances, very mature, lower acidity, slightly different and slightly oddball versus the rest of Champagne. The Aube had a lot of difficulties too, with again with low yields, and but again tends to be a riper vintage with some acidity. And I looked to the Grand Valley de la Marne. Again, I was a great village in 13, but it tends to be more ripe and more akin to the southern Montana Rams, more akin to Ambonnet and that area. And again, a thrilling vintage. And as a blend, 2013 was superb to blend. You could just almost like five or six different vintages in one. You could blend across. Grand Marks are superb in 13. They can just pick their palette of colors and just assemble these beautiful framework, beautiful bouquet of base ones for us, you know.
So, Steve, that's why your Dom Perignon report has a very high score for the 13 vintage, right?
Really?
Agreed. It's a superb wine. And, you know, 13 Dom Perignon as well. They're a winemaking adjustment. Hey, if you're JMIB subscribers, which I hope you all are, you will indeed sort of see that report released. I think it's going to be today, is it? Or maybe soon, Michael. And I talked about... What's that going to be? Sorry?
Yes, I believe so. Correct.
Okay. And that'll talk a little bit about what Dom Perignon do as winemakers. So, you know, it's for me, it's not a question of growers versus, you know, the big Grand Mark winemakers. It's a version of their expression of their terroirs. And you can have Grand terroirs on a very high level, or you can have the fractal terroirs of the growers and different winemaking techniques too. And you know, both are thrilling in their own way and for different reasons. But, you know, 13, Dom Perignon, it's a very sappy style, a very much of the dry extract coming to the fore. A lot of that mouth-watering dry extract acidity. And, you know, it may not age as long as the earlier vintages, you know, for different reasons. And I explain more in the report. But, yeah, it's a wine which is simply superb.
So, Steve, I think now that we've entered into food, I want to just say, hold on, give me a second. Just want to say thank you, Steve, for all the time. Very well researched. Very good job. Thank you.
Okay. And
you've given us inspiration for the next tastings.
Indeed.
Bottle magnum and double magnums or Jarrows of the same vintage of Dom. 20 vintages.
Absolutely, that sounds like a plan, and you know, you just feel sorry for the poor sommelier having to deal with those sort of bottle sizes. But hey, we all have to earn our money, you know. So, thanks, guys. It's been fantastic talking to you for Zoom. Hopefully, this is one of many. I wish you bon appetit, and I'm always here. Please feel free to contact me. You can find me on Twitter. Hopefully, I'll share those details with you after the meeting. I will also publish my facts and notes as well. And enjoy. Good to talk to you guys. Yeah.